Accession number 29957, Reel 3.
This is the second reel of a taped interview with Vic Tengah in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 9th of the 1st, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Vic, you were talking obviously about wanting to become airman, become involved in flying a plane ultimately. Let's talk then about that happening. You mentioned it happening in the 10th month of 1942. Just looking at that month, obviously we have the Battle of El Alamein. So we're looking at October 1942.
Yes. Yes, well, all these things were on, and it seemed to me that we were beginning to get the upper hand in things, and well, it didn't really affect me in any way in that regard, except that I felt that we were getting the upper hand, and I was still plodding away on the ground staff and very anxious to get into aircrew, and whilst I was doing a conversion course from fitter to E, back at Ascot Vale, number one engineering depot, we got a whisper through that some ground staff were going to be allowed to remuster into aircrew.
You mentioned this last time. I wanted to talk to you.
Yes. Well,
okay, right. Now you've made it in.
Yes.
What was to happen next? What was involved in becoming an airman?
Well, it involved, I can remember very, very very vividly the actual lead up to the training. I was carted from Lavington, where I was stationed, out to Somers in Victoria, where we did our initial training course. There was two months of general training, and then you had to go before a categorisation board, and they categorised you as to what you were going to be, either a pilot, an air gunner, or whatever. And luckily, I was categorised as a pilot. This is rather strange, because I mentioned before, my mathematics weren't good, and whereas I passed well in all other subjects, and I didn't do so well in maths, so they must have realised that I wasn't a complete idiot. They gave me an oral examination, and they asked me only one question: what is a third of 100? And I said 33. Is that right? I said, well, that's near enough. And they let me in anyhow. So, I mean, I knew it was a third as well, but I just said 33, and near enough. So anyhow, they passed me. So we did the extra month there, mainly in navigation and things like this, which I thoroughly enjoyed because I was good at algebra at school. I passed that all right too. Then we moved on from there. Eventually, with some of the mates that I had accumulated, three of them in particular, that I had accumulated while I was at Somers. A very enjoyable time it was, once the categorisation was done. From there I was posted across to Tasmania to Western Junction, just I can't think of the name of the port now, but anyhow, it's not far from one of the main cities.
Hobart?
No, Launceston.
Okay.
Launceston. And that's where we did our elementary flying, which was on Tiger Moths.
Okay. Well, what was it like to get your first chance to fly in a plane?
Well, it was very exciting. I quite liked it. But I must impress here that I don't claim to be either a skilled pilot or an exceptionally skilled pilot or an exceptionally brave one. I was just a run-of-the-mill pilot.
All right. Well, before you actually got a chance to fly a plane, what was it like the very first time that you actually went up in one?
Yeah, well, once again, I liked it very much. I had an instructor. I just can't think of his name now. Actually, I had a few instructors, and this particular fellow, he took me up and taught me all the things that had to be done, and he was very satisfied with me. But it took me 7 hours to solo, which was well average, I suppose. It wasn't too bad and it wasn't too good, or there weren't many that I don't think that soloed before then anyhow. So there we went on. Now I was training with I soloed at 7 hours. Well, after that I used to do some solo flying, but I still had an instructor a lot of the time. And I got to 25 hours, and I had to go before, I had to do a test with a CFI, that's the chief flying instructor, that he tested all the pilots at 24 hours. And he put me up for a scrub test. I don't think it was the chief flying instructor. Must have been the chap in charge of the flight. Put me up for a scrub test with the chief flying instructor. And my instructor went off his head. He said, "You're never in a scrubbo class." He said, "I'll see about this." So they gave me 5 hours to improve, and I never heard any more about it whatsoever. I never had to do another test or anything like that. So, and I don't think I was in a scrubbo class either, because I knew what I was doing and I could do all that I was asked to do at that time. And so it went on from there. I went through and did this test and just went on gaining hours. The Tiger Moth is a very sensitive machine. You hold the stick between your thumb and the two top fingers of your right hand, and you've got foot pedals to control the rudder. The stick, of course, takes you up or down or whatever you want to do. And I could do all this, and I've always had just to emphasise how touchy these aeroplanes were, if you held the Tiger straight and level and put your hand out the side, it would turn. But without touching the controls at all, it would still turn. Not a severe turn, but it would wander that way. Well, I went on there, and I had a change of instructors. I can't remember. I think there was only the two, and the second one was a fellow called Rust. He was a flight sergeant, Rust. He was he must have been in his 30s or something like that, getting around 30 or just over, and a family man. And he took me through to the rest of the course, and I did have a test with the chief flying instructor again, I had the test with the chief flying instructor this time, and he said to me, do a slow roll to the port. So I did a slow roll to the port, and then he said, "Now do one to the right," because that's a different procedure going that way. Not procedure, but it's a bit different.
Why?
Well, I never thought of this before, but it's probably because of the thrust of the propeller. It's easier to go with the propeller than against it. So if the propeller's turning clockwise, anti-clockwise, well, you go to the port if it's turning the other way. Well, when you go to starboard, well, you're working against the propeller, the actual torque of the whole aeroplane. Anyhow, I did a slow roll there, and the chief flying instructor said to me, with a little bit of practice, you'd do very, very good slow rolls. So that was all right. I thought this was pretty good, and when I went back, got back again, I still had 2 or 3 hours extra to do. You had to do a certain number of hours. I think it was 50 hours. You had to complete 50 hours flying. And I told Rusty that, CFI told me that with a bit of practice, I'd do slow rolls, good slow roll. And they said, you've still got 3 hours to go, or X hours, I think it was 3 or 4. And they said, go up there and work it off. And I said, what am I going to do? And he said, practice your slow rolls. So I went up there, and I never got around them another slow roll after that. When you get over on your back, and the idea, everything's reversed, you've got to push your stick forward to keep the nose just above the horizon. So you go over and turn that way.
So you're upside down?
Yeah, upside down, so you've got to push the stick forward. It will make yourself go up upside down. Or not go up, but hold that position. And I never got around again. I tried and tried and tried, but when I got on my back, instead of pushing the stick forward, I was pulling it back, and because down underneath you go. I'm a bit of a slow learner because I couldn't work it out, but after that, and then I never had to do a slow roll again. So then we moved on. I passed out all right, but before I left there, Rusty said to me, he said, listen, Vic, he said, don't volunteer for anything, and don't go to England if you can avoid it. So I remembered those words, but I didn't get a chance one way or any other to make a decision anyhow.
Did he say why you shouldn't go to a place like England?
Because at that time, Bomber Command was the main, that's where most Australian air crew went, to Bomber Command. And Bomber Command was suffering very, very heavy losses. They were suffering more losses, excuse me, than any other service, and somewhere comparable to the First World War. For instance, the Australians that went to England and served in Bomber Command comprised of 10% of the total Australian servicemen. But their casualties were 20% of the, or their losses were 20% of the total of those people. I got a frog in my throat. Yeah, well, that was the position, but I did. We went from there to Malala, where I was once again involved with the Cheetah engines. And they powered the Avro Anson's that we were flying. The Avro Anson was a very docile aircraft too. It was light on the controls, but it was pretty forgiving. I had one of the mates that I covered up with in the first when we first left Summers. He was my, we used to fly together at one stage. There were two sections at Malala. It was the, I think they called it the intermediate flying and then advanced flying. Well, in the intermediate flying, you did most of your flying with an instructor. You still had to do a lot of solos, but you flew with an instructor a lot. And when you passed out of that first thing, that's when they used to give you your wings in the early days. Once you became, got through the first stage of that course, that's where you received your wings. But I think there's that many people got out of it sooner or later and they still had their wings. So they cut that out. You didn't get your wings until you actually finished all your training after that. So I was one of those that, I was in the area that didn't get their wings at that time. It didn't matter anyhow. We had a piece of white in our cap and that was enough for me and enough for others. We went on to advanced flying, and there you flew with another trainee on most occasions, actually. You'd go on different exercises like bombing or navigation or whatever, and you'd be with another trainee. He would do half of the trip as bombing or bomb aimer or whatever, navigator. That's only two categories that were involved. He would do those, and then after he'd done his time, it changed over. He did the flying while you did the navigating. And this is where my judgment failed me a bit. But as I said, I'm just a sprog pilot, and not a brilliant one, but a run of the mill. We had a bombing exercise, which it was supposed to be, they called it masthead height bombing. And they had a pylon with a ring on the top of it, which was, I suppose, about 20 foot high. And the idea was that you would come in at masthead height. You'd come in, on a slight downward path, release your bomb and then climb away. Well, Laurie Wilson, who is not with us anymore, but he was a friend that I was with most of the time through my flying business, finished up a DFC. He got his bombs away and did very well with them, but it made me a bit worried. I said, look, Laurie, if you don't pull out a bit sooner, we're going to hit the target. And so my turn came, and I got my 7 bombs away, and on the 8th one, I hit the target with my tail wheel. So, and the reason for this was that instead of easing the aeroplane back, I just jerked the stick back, and the nose went up, but the aircraft actually squashed along and hit the tail wheel. So I climbed away and tried all the controls, and everything was all right. So we went back to Malalar to land. And when I got to Malalar and got the stage of getting the stick right back into your stomach, so that you gradually lost height until she just settled down, and I could do this very well. But it wouldn't come right back in, so it was going to drop in. Well, I couldn't get it in anyhow. So, I didn't know for a moment what to do. But the thing is, if I didn't do something in a very, very quick time, we'd stall and fall in from about 20 or 30 feet, which wouldn't have been nice. And so I grabbed the throttle and put more revs on, and this saved us, and I was able to let it down slowly on the throttle, easing back until she settled down further and further, and we got it back that way. That was in the second half of that course, which at that stage finished my flying training in Australia, except for a little bit here and there. I got my wings and...
What was it like to get your wings? How did that make you feel?
Yeah, well, it made me feel very well, very, very proud, because I'd wanted them so much. The day that I went into air crew and got that white patch in my forage cap, that I knew then that I was on the way, and to actually complete the course and get the wings was really, really a pleasure. I mentioned that they did a little bit extra. I came home on an pre-embarkation leave, which set me back quite a long way in the overall scheme of things, because nearly all the fellows that I, because I enlisted in air crew from Laverton in Victoria, I got my long service leave and came home to Perth, and then when it came, by this time the Perth was flooded with Yanks, and couldn't get a drink because the barmaids would serve the Yanks before they served you, and they didn't take any notice of an Australian being there at all. I often said that if it had been the Japanese fleet that had sailed in there, as long as they had two bobbin pockets to rattle around, they'd be in front. That was my feeling at the time, anyhow. And I came home, and because of all the action that was going on, there was that much traffic on the trains from Perth to the eastern states, and I suppose Vicky Burke, the other way, I don't know. But I couldn't get back to Laverton on time. So actually, now this held me back quite a lot, because the fellows that I was on course with and finished the course in Malala were mostly Victorians and South Australians, one or two New South Welshmen, I suppose, but they had their fortnight's pre-embarkation leave, and 2 days after that was over, they were on the ship going overseas. Well, I didn't get back to Melbourne until quite a long time after they'd gone, and eventually when I did get back there, we hung around there for a short time, and then the posting was overseas, of course, and we joined the a ship called the New Amsterdam, quite a big ship, very big, and on board this ship they had about 600 Africa Corps prisoners of war. Now they were pretty tough people, these people from the Africa Corps. Anyhow, the trip was pretty comfortable. It was a shame to see a ship like that. It was a real top passenger ship, with all beautiful panelled walls and everything, and they'd erected bunks against all the walls, the upper and lower bunks, by just hammering nails through some pine and into the walls, and I thought it was terrible, and it was a good trip.
Before we talk about your trip, obviously you've spoken about a couple of things there, and I wanted to discuss with you a couple of things. You mentioned, obviously, your experience of being a pilot, and you mentioned a couple of instances there that were a bit, close to comfort. Did that ever make you think what you were getting into was less than safe?
No, not really. They didn't worry me. I mean, they worried me to the extent that maybe they would penalise me in some way or other, but nothing happened. I wasn't hauled over the coals at all for it.
But the fact that, flying a plane is fraught with a few dangers.
Yeah, well, I accepted those because I always thought that was so, and it was up to yourself to a very large extent. And I might mention here that in all the time, I didn't fly a lot of time. When I say all the time, all my flying experiences, I never had a malfunction in a plane of any description at any time. Now, that's I only flew the normal training planes, the Tiger Moth, the Anson. I flew Airspeed Oxfords, which weren't a very nice aeroplane. I didn't have a good name anyhow. And then I went on to Wellingtons, which that was one that I had trouble with. I'll explain that a bit later on.
But up until your trip away, it wasn't, I mean, you're hearing stories about ME-109, Stukas, you know, Japanese Zeros. These are precision fighter planes. Yeah. And here you are, flying around in Tiger Moths and Avro Ansons, and they're not exactly known for their...
No,
speed
but
speed and agility.
Yeah, but we knew we would be flying something better than Ansons and Oxfords. I mean, that had to happen. The worst one of the lot that was on operations, in my view, was the Wellington. But the people who served a tour of 30 trips on the. Wellington, reckon they were a great aeroplane, and so it was with the people who flew them in Bomber Command.
All right, well, we'll talk about that too. Here you are, obviously heading off. Mm. To what degree were you anxious to get away, itching to go?
Well, I don't know. I think I was quite happy to be going. I wasn't concerned about it. I did mention Rusty, didn't I? He told me not to go to England, but at that stage I had no idea of where I would be going or anything, so it didn't worry me.
Had you thought about, you know, the fact that you're leaving now, you may actually never come home?
Oh yes, I thought of that many times, but I still went. I was going to say later on, but I should say it here, I suppose, because you've asked the question, but the DFC is quite a coveted thing, although in some squadrons they dish them out like a meal, but in the squadron that I flew with, there wasn't a DFC given out at any stage that I know of. Nobody got one. The people that had done the tour and one thing or another, they didn't get one. Nobody got one that I know of in my squadron. So I reckon they should have given me one simply because I went, because I kept going. I reckon I earned a DFC every time I saw a battle order and still went. But that's only what I think, of course, because I suppose some other people anyhow had the same feeling. That's from the time you... That battle order came out, that was worse than the actual trip. You worry about it the whole time, you've got 8 hours or so to worry about it, and that's what got me.
Well, we can talk about that too when we get closer to that point, but obviously here you are on the ship, you've got some Africa Corps.
Yeah.
Did you have a chance to speak to any of them?
No, they used to bring them up on deck every day. Of course they would halt down in the bowels of the ship, and they'd bring them up for a bit of sunshine every day. But the worst thing about it, and I can't understand today, the bloody mentality of those people in charge of all kinds of things. They're actually in charge now. Here's 600 Africa Corps, and they give the sprog air crew, the sergeants, just finished their course and going to England, they put them on guard with a 303 each, and none of them ever handled a 303 before. They could have taken that ship over just like that if they were awake up to it, and that's my view anyhow. And I can't see how they could have stopped them, because... Oh, truly, we never thought I could handle a 303 because I had so much time in my in the army. But once again, you can only, if you're experienced with a 303, you can only get one shot away before you've got to reload, just up and back with a bolt. But that takes a little bit of time. You can't fire it like a Tommy gun or anything like that. So I don't know why they didn't wake up to this fact, but there were these rosy-cheeked boys with these bloody big guns standing around, and they would have put their rifle down before they shot anybody. Oh, this is what I think. But I dodged that because, you know, my father said don't volunteer. The first thing I did, well, the first day we were, or before we left the place, before we left Melbourne, the CO, a fella called Crennan, squadron leader Crennan, was the OC of troops. He was in charge of, well, all the aircrew or all the troops on board. And they called the trip Crennan Ferry Cruise. They had a printing press on this machine. I've still got the magazine that was printed. It's called Crennan Ferry Cruise. Anyhow, the food was good.